The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Actually, 2 hours of great information on fascinating and important subjects. Boy, it's happening again with my sound level. It was coming right up, but now it's taking a long time to do so. I don't know what's going on here. And if I move my mic around, then it gets crazy. I'm just watching it and trying to figure out what I should do. I don't think there's anything wrong on my Skype. I'm going to take a look at it right now. I'm sorry for such a bad opening. There's no reason this should be happening like this. Audio settings. I'm going to move my mic up a little bit. My mic setting up a little bit. But I seem to be down at the bottom. I'm not even being heard. There it's coming up finally. Finally! Sometimes it does this, and for a while I thought it had stopped doing this, but it doesn't seem to have stopped. Well, I'm going to start all over, and I'm going to say good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining me for tonight's Heretics Hour. Actually, as I said, it's 2 hours, and tonight I think I have a good show, something that I'm going to enjoy doing, and the day is Monday, March 17th, 2014, which is St. Patrick's Day, which I'm sure most of you know. But before I start in on that, I want to once again thank some contributors, which include our friend Jaime Schwartz, once again from Brooklyn, New York, and sometimes Tel Aviv, who has come through again for our cause here, and a couple of new people, a wonderful couple from Australia who sent me pictures of themselves. And they are a beautiful pair in a beautiful home. I won't give their name, but they make me think of what Richard Edmonds said on Saturday, that white people are wonderful people. It's so true. And Daniel from New Hampshire. It's the first time we ever got anything from New Hampshire. Daniel says he likes the shows I've been doing lately and I should do more like these. So my sincere thanks to these three. It means so much because it's cheering and it makes me feel connected to the listeners. It really does, to hear from a few of them. I do get emails, however, and I'm always glad to get those too. So it's St. Patrick's Day. Well, my gosh, de Blasio held New York's traditional St. Patrick's Day breakfast at Gracie Mansion with the Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny. I can't quite believe that the Irish Prime Minister comes all the way over to New York to have breakfast with the governor or the mayor of New York. But the mayor boycotted the parade because organizers said marchers were not allowed to carry gay-friendly signs or identify themselves as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. Well, good for these organizers. In this thing that I read, it didn't say, and I really had some things I wanted to say about St. Patrick's Day, but I hadn't looked at the news. Since I hooked up my new computer, I don't have the same, page that comes up when I come on. So I don't even see the news anymore. I used to have, my opening page was, Yahoo News page, and I didn't go back to that because I'm so sick of looking at it. It's got so much horrible stuff on it. But then I don't bother to look at the news all day. I go to the Daily Stormer to see what news they have. But I think I'm missing out on a lot. I'm going to have to get back onto a news page because I don't find myself ever going and checking it out. And I'm going to miss some important things. So I didn't read about the parades for today until right before the show, and I saw this, and I thought it was pretty important to mention, because here we have, I think it says here somewhere what last year was, but they don't tell you who these organizers are. In this news story that I saw, They just tell you what you what they want you to know, and they don't give any time or any voice to the organizers who decided they didn't want to allow lesbian LGBT people to be able to identify themselves. That is, carry signs promoting their LGBT stuff. Why should they be able to do that in St. Patrick's Day parade? It's disgusting, really. And they have no right to demand it, but they do. And look, the New York mayor, stands with them and refused to march in the parade, but he did to have breakfast with the prime minister, and the prime minister had breakfast with him and didn't get mad at him about it. And in Dublin today, in their parade, they're allowing the LGBT people to march and say and do whatever they want in that parade. But I also learned that Guinness, you know, the beer company, abruptly dropped its support a day before the event. The mayor had said a week or so ago that he wasn't going to march, and who needs him anyway? But the Guinness people just decided the day before, these cowards, I mean, they probably were given all kinds of threats. They're a Dublin-based company. They pulled their sponsorship assets, including on-air presence, parade participation, and any promotional materials that weren't already printed, although the beer maker had already made a payment to parade organizers. Other beer companies took part in the boycotts, with Samuel Adams withdrawing sponsorship of the Boston parade, and Heineken bagging, whatever that means, New York's parade because of the exclusion of gays. Well, they're afraid to lose that the business of these people. And there's not enough regular people who will boycott these companies who've done this to make them worry about that. They're only worried about the gays, because the gays are organized, and you see how they do things, just like the Jews. They insist, I've always said they were just like the Jews, and that's one of the things that's wrong with them. They care about themselves, their group interests. They don't care about anything else, and they're not going to be good white nationalists or anything, because if that anything in white nationalism conflicts with what's good for the gays, they're going to go for what's good for the gays. That's what they care about. They see themselves as a special group, and they need to get all the rights they can, and then some. So, and then the church. Roman Catholic Cardinal Timothy Dolan, who greeted passing dignitaries in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral, wearing a woolen Irish cap over his red cardinal's skull cap, said he supports the participation of individual gays and hoped the St. Patrick's Day could be a day of unity and joy. Well, he's at least saying individual gays, that they, you know, and they are not excluded, but they're not able to carry these signs and come in big groups. But here's what he said. He said, this is a quote, "I know that there are thousands and thousands of gay people marching in this parade. I know it, and I'm glad they are." People who say there are not very many, and here I'm using this word gay, but I'll use it. It's easier. But people who say that there aren't that many gay people, there aren't that many homosexual people to worry about, why are there thousands and thousands of them just marching in a parade in New York? How many people marched altogether in this parade? I don't know. But these people are everywhere, and growing, and they are pressuring businesses and companies, just as the Jews have done all through the so many years now, certainly all through the 20th century in the United States. The Jews have used their pressure on everything and everyone, you know, businesses, organizations, the government agencies, what have you, school systems, to get their way, and now the gays have become doing the same thing. And they're the ones who would be probably, we could see in this 21st century, who are following along that same path. So it kind of puts a damper on the feeling of St. Patrick's Day, but I wanted to just mention it since I like to kind of mention holidays. But I have to admit that when I looked up things about, I wanted to find out about Irish culture. There's not much culture. Irish are big here in this country because a lot of them came to the United States during the potato famine. So there's a large population of Irish. They're mostly Catholic. I don't know how good a Catholics these people are anymore, but one time they were very good Catholics. But the Ireland was always, the people were always poor, and that happens a lot in Catholic church-dominated countries, at least from in the past, where the church managed to keep the poor people poor and not complaining too much because they promised them the afterlife and they all went along with that, you know. And so there was a aristocratic level in Ireland, and a lot of them were actually English, but the Irish people were didn't make much progress back for all. And what progress they've made in more modern times, more contemporary times, has been kind of fakey stuff where they end up, they borrowing a lot, you know, in the getting in caught in the debt system. And they had this big boom in Ireland, and then they started having a bust. And I don't know exactly where they are now. But St. Patrick, or this person named Patrick, was supposedly an Englishman. Or he was born in England. He was kidnapped by some bad Irish marauders and taken to Ireland. And he was working there. He wasn't given, you know, he didn't have any high status or anything. He was working doing something, not very much fun. And, you know, years went by, and then somehow he managed to escape and go back to England, and he reunited with his family, and he was from a wealthy family in England. But then he had these dreams, you see, and he was a good Catholic at that time, and so he then, when he was back in England, he had another dream that told him that he was needed back in Ireland to convert, to bring the faith to the Irish people. So he went back and he was preaching and all, and he lived a life of austerity, and he was in Northern Ireland, and he converted, you know, thousands of people. And that's the whole story there. And so he became the patron saint. He died on a March 17th, which is why this March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. And then all these legends grew up around him. And in Ireland, he's, of course, the foremost saint, the national saint or whatever. And on St. Patrick's Day, it's customary to wear shamrocks. So the Ireland is known for its shamrocks. And they say that the three-leafed, what we call, what is that thing called? I forgot to write that down. I don't call it a shamrock. We used to call it something. Three-leaf clover. Yeah, the three-leaf clover. And you're always, as a kid, we were always looking for four-leaf clovers. We're supposed to be lucky, and once in a while we found one. But the three-leaf clover was used by Patrick to teach the Irish pagans about the Holy Trinity. And they seem to take to that very well, because I've read, I don't know how true any of this stuff is, but in pagan Ireland, three was a significant number, and the Irish had many triple deities. They had, you know, different groups had different deities, but the triple spiral symbol appears at many ancient megalithic sites in Ireland, and so it was easier to teach them, to get them to like the idea of the Trinity, the God, three in one God. And then because of that, the color green's always been associated with Ireland since the 1640s, it says. And they had the, And green ribbons and shamrocks have been worn on, you know, since 1680s. After a while, they adopted blue, but then they went back to green later on. And the phrase "wearing of the green" comes from a song of the same name, which laments United Irishmen supporters being persecuted for wearing green. They had a rebellion in 1798 against British rule, and I think that is when the wearing of the green was written. And so it's still very green. And you know, I used to live in Chicago, and that's famous. That's famous on St. Patrick's Day. Of course, Mayor Daley was Irish, and he was mayor for so long. And I don't know if he started it or if it started before that, but every St. Patrick's Day they dye the Chicago River green. And I saw some pictures of different places where there's even in Ireland, there's some places where they dye, they color the water green for this day. And then they talked about, I was looking up representative dishes, Irish dishes, you know, Irish cuisine. And that's where I have to say that Irish really fall down is in their cuisine, because there's, I don't think there's anything that you could call an Irish cuisine. I figured there would be Irish stew, and there was, and that was the number one thing, Irish stew. And you know what Irish stew is consists of? Just, it looked like in the picture, and it didn't say any differently, just some meat, whatever kind of meat you might have, and potato and carrot. That's it. I mean, just typical stew, you know. But I would like to see a little more vegetables in there. But no, it was just potatoes and carrots. And I read on Wikipedia that that most of the vegetables in Ireland were mostly potatoes. We know that the potato was introduced at some point, and it took so well, and it was they didn't have a very good diet in Ireland. So then the potato became super popular, and they ate lots of potatoes. And of course, it was the potato blight that caused the famine that caused so many Irish to die and to starve to death, and also to emigrate, mostly, I think, to the U.S., but probably to a lot of other places. But this, the vegetables are, I found this interesting, mainly potatoes, carrots, and cabbage. Pretty basic stuff, you know, pretty basic. And some other of their dishes besides Irish stew is bacon and cabbage. That's pretty pretty down home. I like cabbage, and bacon and cabbage is good, but you know, they probably they have something called like a shepherd pie. But that's like, what is that? Mashed potatoes. Just a bowl full of something with mashed potatoes with a few carrots and some meat cut up in it, and then maybe you bake it. That's it. More potatoes, see, and coddle and coal cannon, which is a mixture of potatoes and I think it was kale. They also have kale there along with the cabbage. Pretty, it's like they just never developed a cuisine. Now, I don't mean to be picking on the Irish, but in that area, they didn't develop anything much. And of course, the British don't have a very good cuisine either. They have some things, you know, that are supposed to be quite nice, but some roasts and so on. But you know, that they're not known for their food. And I was looking over this last night. I decided that the more southern countries are much more, they pay a lot more attention to what they eat and have a higher developed cuisine than northern countries, which are stay pretty basic. I'd have to admit that. Of course, Italy is maybe the queen of cuisine in my book, and Spain is also pretty good. But for me, though, Hungarian cooking, Hungarian cuisine is just excellent, wonderful, delicious. And the Polish is pretty good too, really. And then Mexico, taking from Spain, Mexico has actually has very good food, but it's got an awful lot of fat in it, but it's good, very tasty. All right, what I'm going to do tonight is talk about another anniversary, and then I'm going to talk about some things that I've been wanting to for a while, and that is some traitors, you know, the enemies in our midst, the enemies that are inside the gates all the time. And in this case, I'm going to talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller in Germany, and what they did, and how they're praised today as great heroes and courageous men and so on, but what they really were like. And then I'm going to finish off with Britain's Edward Miliband, who once I discovered that he was a Polish Jew, that both his parents were Jews from Poland, and he doesn't have any British in him himself, and he's the head of the Labour Party and could very well at some point become the British Prime Minister. I thought, gosh, we got to pay more attention to this man. What a story he's got, too. So I'm going to start out now with something that is close to my heart, and that is that always thrills me. That is the Austria-Germany Anschluss, or the Anschluss of Austria to Germany that took place in 1938. And that is because, the actual anniversary for that was the 12th and 13th of this month, which I didn't get to at that time. But the anniversary of the speech that Hitler gave in Vienna was Saturday, the 15th. And I missed that because I did something else, and that's all right. And I did talk about the Anschluss last year. Last year was the 75th anniversary, but I thought I'd add a few new things this year to it because I like to remember it. And so the overall point of this is that the way that it is portrayed today as that Germany attacked Austria and kind of went in there and made a tyranny over the people. I've got a few quotes here like that. And the Austrians were, you know, the victims of Hitler's tyrannical government and so on. And all of this is just so totally false. And it's just amazing the lies that they continue to put out. And I got something from Richard Edmonds after Saturday's show, which I thought was very good. And what I'm doing tonight fits into that. And most of what I do fits into it. And he wrote, the method, in my opinion, he had been looking over our website, the White Network, and he was commenting on our mission statement, things like that. And I forgot that at the beginning of the show that the White Network has been, it's not a big deal at all. I don't take it as a big deal at all. But the White Network has been put on the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center's hate map. They updated their hate map not too long ago, and I mentioned it maybe last week or so. It's put on there. So for whatever that means. Anyway, Richard said that in his opinion, to achieve the goal of white group consciousness and solidarity, which we mentioned in our mission statement, is to attack politically and publicly the politicians of the Anglo-American establishment for their disastrous conduct of public affairs this last 100 years. And he says, to put it in a nutshell, we have to destroy their moral standing as the good guys. In my opinion, and I think we are in complete agreement on this, the key is to destroy the legitimacy of the claims of the so-called Holocaust. Well, I certainly certainly agree with that. And so tonight I'm doing a little bit more to destroy the moral standing of the so-called good guys. I'm not going to actually be talking about the Holocaust, but so just as a real quick background, the Austrians always wanted to join with Germany, and they were allies in World War I, and when Austria-Hungary was dismantled, and the monarchy was destroyed, and Hungary was, all kinds of territory was taken from both Austria and Hungary and Germany after World War I by those people who were running the peace process, the peace treaty process in Versailles. Then Austria was left in such a small little country. Hungary was too, but Austria was full of Germans, see, and the part that was cut off were a lot of the non-German people had lived, and so what was left there of Austria was mostly German, and they wanted to join up with Germany again. They wanted to become a part of Germany. They didn't have any great love for being an independent state, not at that time, because they were left with no balanced resources, and they hardly could compete with other nations in their trade and so on. So they were very poor in Austria for a long time after that, very poor. And, but the masters of the universe would not allow the Austrians to join up with Germany. And so they all just kept going along. And when Hitler took power, they became really enthused, and, they watched all the great things that were happening in Germany, and Germany just went through a rebirth and became more and more prosperous in just a few years' time. And the Austrians wanted to be a part of that. They really did. But, so by 1938, things had, progressed to such a degree that Hitler had a lot of, choices and could do a lot of things. One of the things he wanted to do was to take care of, this thing with Austria. So I'm going to start out and begin where with this sentence. Most people had believed, this is from Wikipedia, saying that most people had believed that a majority of Austrians opposed the Anschluss. When the German troops went into Austria and they were greeted as liberators and with flowers and big smiles and salutes and happiness and great joy, it shocked everyone, and the powers that be couldn't even admit that this was happening and had to pretend that Hitler was attacking Austria. Austria had been attacked and they'd marched in there and taken over. And here are some of the things that they said at the time. They said that Hitler decided to formally absorb the country as a German province, where they wanted to be absorbed as a German province. And Hitler's travel, here's where they admit that Hitler's travel through Austria became a triumphal tour that climaxed in Vienna on 15th March 1938, when around 200,000 I don't know if that's a smaller number than there really was, because one, there's pictures of that, and that big plaza in Vienna, the Heldenplatz, Square of Heroes, was absolutely packed, and it's large, and you see this picture from this one picture that you can see on Wikipedia where Hitler is up on the podium, you know, and he's, you know, giving his speech, and out there you see just a sea of people just all close together and all standing there just quietly, you know, listening. But they say it was about 200,000 German Austrians gathered there to hear him say, in front of tens of thousands of cheering people, I don't know why they put it that way, but that this is part of his speech: the oldest eastern province of the German people shall be, from this point on, the newest bastion of the German Reich, followed by, and then after that he spoke of his greatest accomplishment being completing the annexing of Austria to form a greater German Reich, by saying, as leader and chancellor of the German nation and Reich, I announce to German history now the entry of my homeland into the German Reich. Well, of course, they all went crazy and, you know, yelling and cheering, and everybody was happy and thrilled. And Willy Winger, who I have some of his writing on my website, carolynyager.net, which if you haven't read, you should go and find his name over on the right-hand side and read it. A wonderful man in his 80s who is still with us. And his brother, Leopold, died at the age of 23 in defending Vienna. He was a pilot. And we have a lot of his stuff there. But Willie always says, and can't, you know, wants people to know that how the Austrians were so happy at this time, that everybody was so happy. Now, his family was already National Socialists, and they were working to have the National Socialists in Austria win and, you know, and get grow and so on. And so they were especially happy, but he said everybody was happy. It was such a wonderful time, and it's really so bad the way they try to portray it differently. Now, what really moved me was something that Hitler said later on the 25th of March. This was now the 15th and that he gave his speech in Vienna, and 10 days later he was in Königsberg, and he was giving a speech, and he said, "Certain foreign newspapers have said that we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say, even in death, they cannot stop lying." I love that line. "Even in death, they cannot stop lying. I have, in the course of my political struggle, won much love from my people. But when I crossed the former frontier," meaning into Austria, because it wasn't a frontier any longer, it was all one country, "there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators." But I just love that he says here how much love he has received from his people. But he never received so much, or was hit him so hard, as when he crossed into Austria. It makes me choke up a little bit. Okay, so there's this picture on somewhere on Wikipedia in their picture pages of the people in Salzburg on I guess it's on the 15th or the 12th. The troops first marched in on the 12th, and Salzburg is up there close to the border, in sort of, so it might be around then, but it doesn't matter. It's right. It's when the troops were coming. And on this picture page, it's a lovely picture of a German soldier of some kind and two young women. Well, they might be sisters. They look kind of alike. One is maybe 18 or 19. The other might be 10 or 12. And the little one is holding a picture of Adolf Hitler in her hand up against her chest. And they're dressed very nicely. And they're all smiling for the camera. And there's this handsome young fellow in a uniform down below, like he's sitting on the running board of this vehicle, or he's kneeling or something, with nice, thick, dark hair, good-looking young man smiling. Makes me think of Willie Chrisman. He looks somewhat similar when Willie was young, and he was about that age at that time. But it's not him. And there's some, you know, there's a swastika. Oh, this other older girl is carrying a swastika flag, holding, and they're all looking very happy. And in the background, there's all these people with their arms raised, listening to some speeches on a platform. And it says the caption for the picture says, "On Saturday, when the German troops marched into Salzburg, the entire population had a frenzy of enthusiasm. Everywhere you looked, radiant faces, and many people wore pictures of the leader, and almost all waving swastika flags." And then they have a note. Wikipedia and somebody who's doing that added a note to it and said, "This description has been identified as biased or incorrect. It's an original Nazi propaganda description." Yeah, well, it might be an original Nazi description, but it's true. But see, this is where they just can't stand it. They have the hardest time of all. Maybe not of all. They have a hard time with some other things, but they have a real hard time dealing with the fact that the Austrian people, who were German people, were so thrilled and welcomed Hitler, and there was not a single bit of trouble or anything. Then they want to exaggerate that in Vienna, they had some Jews scrubbing some stuff off the sidewalk. Well, they wrote stuff on the sidewalk, that somehow was anti-Hitler or something. So, the police that were there and made them scrub it off themselves, but they make out like they're being punished and having to do something that's not necessary to do, and being humiliated and so on. Here's something else. I'm not sure what it amounts to, but I must thought it was good. From the history on the net.com, and Sace Incourt, that he is the one who was a national, represented the National Socialists, and he finally got into the government of Dollfuss, and then when Hitler and when the National Socialist troops came down, then he was named prime minister or something of the new Ostmark. It says here that he took his place, you know, and immediately asked Hitler to send the Oh, I know. When he was made Minister of the Interior, he immediately asked Hitler to send the German army into Austria to help restore order. So this way, Hitler was able to enter Austria on a kind of a legal way by invitation. And along with the army came the Gestapo and the SS to deal with opponents of the Nazis. This is the way the history on the net writes it. Here's where they say Schuschnigg, he was the former prime minister who got kicked out, found himself cleaning public toilets. I don't know if that's true at all. While Austria's Jews were made to get down and scrub streets on their hands and knees. Again, you see, that was one instance because of something that they had put on the sidewalk. They make out like all the Jews had to get down and scrub the streets on their hands and knees just to clean them or something. And then they say before long they would find themselves in concentration camps while the Austrian people lived under a Nazi regime of terror. That's why I put that there. While the Austrian people, so this is how they write about it, even today. even today, knowing all that we know, they'll say that the Austrian people lived under a regime of terror after that took place. Well, I won't read any more of that. So I think that's all I had to say about that. Just wanted to remember it. And so now I'm going to move on to the White Rose Society in Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer, very well known Christian pastor, Protestant Christian pastor, who was a outspoken opponent of the National Socialist regime in Third Reich Germany. And so, you know, it's like there's this thing I found that said, who opposed Hitler? And these are the main opposition groups to that, according to this thing, to Hitler's regime. The Catholic Archbishop of Munster, von Galen, he is the one who campaigned for the end of the euthanasia program of mentally incurably ill people. We might get into that a little bit later on, but I'm going to talk about that a lot more one of these days. He's one. Well, see, we have quite a few Christian groups. There's the Catholic Archbishop. He had no problem with Hitler. He had no problem with him at all. It was just this euthanasia program that he thought was going too far, and he spoke out about that. And then Hitler didn't want to fight with him and didn't want to fight with everybody, and so he just ended it. It had already accomplished quite a bit. So then some Catholic priests, there was in 1937, there was the Pope's message with burning concern, where the Pope from the Vatican wrote in some kind of a, you know, official thing to all the churches, didn't send it to the regime, but sent it to all the churches secretly. And they read it on Palm Sunday in their churches, all these priests did. And in it, he did a lot of attacking of Hitler, saying that he was damaging the church with his policies and so on. This was in 1937. But then they mentioned the White Rose group of students at Munich University. And I find this White Rose Society so interesting. I just can't get enough of it. I keep wanting to talk about it. It's a total legend in my mind, like Anne Frank, only it's better than Anne Frank. It's more interesting than the Anne Frank story. But it's just as false, you know. I mean, it's been played up to make heroes and heroines rather than, giving the true facts of what was going on. And I'm going to mention that in a minute. So a little others, there was the Social Democratic Party had a paramilitary wing called the Reichsbanner, which sabotaged railway lines and acted as spies. I don't know how effective they were. But then there was a group called the Edelweiss, which I've heard of, but I would have to do quite a bit more to find out if what's being said about them is real or true or just, publicity or propaganda, because they're young people who rejected Nazi values. They drank alcohol and danced to jazz. So what? They call themselves the Edelweiss Pirates, and they sometimes put anti-Nazi slogans around and beat up Nazi officials. How did they manage to do that? I don't know. The head of this group was killed. The head of this group. Man, okay. The head of this group in 1944, all of them, they killed the Gestapo chief. I have to read about that. The Nazis publicly hanged 12 of them. I don't really know too much anything about that. And then we come to Martin Niemöller, who formed the Confessional Church in opposition to Hitler, but he was not opposed to Hitler in the beginning. And his story, as being in he survived, and he was just held in concentration, in a concentration camp or two, for quite a while because he wouldn't stop what he was doing. And then the Protestant pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is the most important one to be Bonhoeffer, I'm going to talk about him. And then the Kreisau Circle, which we'll talk about a little bit, that was actually what led to was the group that planted, that did the Valkyrie bomb explosion, the Colonel Stauffenberg and so on. That was what they call themselves or how they get started. And they're called that. Anyway, the White Rose Group and Niemöller and Bonhoeffer and then the Kreisau Circle are all considered today, of course, to be wrongly persecuted and wrongly executed, in whichever case it is. And they are heroes in Germany and because they opposed the Third Reich. So the White Rose Society, I've said this before, I'm just going to cover it real quickly, that they just can't, they're portrayed as being these noble and idealistic young people who were trying to do the right thing and trying to, you know, stand up for freedom and so on. And were terribly wrongly put to death and so on. There were serious charges held against these students. They were trying to bring down their own government when it was at war. They were trying to convince the troops to stop fighting and to lose the war on purpose. And the men in this group, they were young men, but they were men. They were all medical students, and they were all commissioned officers. And they spent part of their time, you know, on the front and part of their time back in school. And so they had officer rank, and they were working to undermine the soldiers in the military while they were. And they were being paid by the state. They had a salary for the work they did, you know, for what they did, because they were officers and they spent time on the front as medical orderlies and so on. And then this Karl Huber was a middle-aged college professor, so he has no excuse for what he was doing. And in their own words, when they spoke about both privately and publicly, they cared more about Jews and Russians and POWs than they did for their own nation's soldiers. And this is what they learned from their religious teachers. Yeah, and they read a lot of books and writings of various religious, you know, thinkers and theologians and so on, and writers. And they are very, you know, they get carried away with all of that. And this is what they learned, to go against their own nation in order to stand up for the persecuted ones, the less strong ones, the weak ones, the Jews, and in this case, Russians and the Russian POWs. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Prussian, and so was Niemöller a Prussian. He was born in Silesia, which is now Poland, in 1906, and that was considered, you know, Prussian territory. And he was very serious, seminary student, very, very serious about religion. And he was a good student, so he completed everything before he was quite old enough to be ordained. You had to be 25 to be ordained, and he finished everything when he was 24. So he went to the United States in 1930 for postgraduate study. And he did a teaching fellowship at New York City's Union Theological Seminary. And although he found the American seminary not up to his exacting German standards, he's quoted as saying, "There is no theology here." He still liked it there, and he says he had a life-changing experience while there and life-changing friendships. And he studied under Reinhold Niebuhr, who is a German theologian who was in the United States and at that theological seminary and always was there. He may have been born in the U.S., as far as I know. And but Bonhoeffer, I always want to call him Hoffer, but it's really Bonhoeffer, met Frank Fisher, a black fellow seminarian, a Negro, who introduced him to Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And Bonhoeffer taught Sunday school and formed a lifelong love for African-American spirituals. And in which he brought his collection of records back to Germany. So, you know, he really got into all of that universalist stuff. He heard Adam Clayton Powell, who was a black leader, New York City leader. They're all preachers back then. You know, every black who became a leader of black people was always a preacher of some kind in a church. Adam Clayton Powell Sr., he had the gospel of social justice. That's what he preached. And Bonhoeffer liked that. And Bonhoeffer became sensitive to social injustices experienced by minorities, which, you see, they didn't have minorities in Germany. They just had some Jews, but they weren't being mistreated at that time. And so when he went to the United States, he really got into this. Oh boy, minorities who are being not given justice, and he also was concerned that talked about the ineptitude of the church to bring about integration. He was all for integration, and he heard the black Christ preached with rapturous passion and vision. He wrote back home that the black Christ is preached here with rapturous passion and vision. He traveled by car through the United States. He learned how to drive, and he traveled by car through the states, and he was invited to speak on the subject of peace. And he visited other countries too, Italy, Libya, Spain, Mexico, and Cuba, as well as the United States. And it opened him up to ecumenism. And he was an ecumenist from then on. And ecumenism refers to the idea of a Christian unity in the literal meaning that there should be a single church. It's not the same as non-denominational Christianity, and it's not the same as interfaith dialogue or interfaith pluralism, which aims at a kind of unity or cooperation among diverse religions. But ecumenism is, I didn't know this, but and I don't quite understand it, but it's supposed to be that you know, bringing about a single church. So he thought that was good. In November 1931, he was 25, and so he was old enough to be ordained. He had returned to Germany. And he was deeply interested in this ecumenism. And so he was appointed by the World Alliance for Promoting International Friendship through the Churches, which was a forerunner of the World Council of Churches. He was appointed as one of three European youth secretaries. So he is, you know, and he's still only 25 years old. They say that his promising career was altered by Hitler's rise to power on January 30th, 1933. He was a determined, let's see, 4 minutes. He was a determined opponent of the regime, Hitler's regime, from its first days. So 2 days after Hitler was installed as chancellor, Bonhoeffer delivered a radio address in which he attacked Hitler and warned Germany against slipping into an idolatrous cult of the Führer, who could very well turn out to be a Wehrführer, or a misleader rather than a leader, or a seducer, is another word to describe a Wehrführer. So he made himself outspokenly anti-Hitler, who is now chancellor, right from the beginning. And as he was giving this radio address, he was cut off the air in the middle of a sentence. But it says here, and this is Wikipedia, though it is unclear whether the newly elected Nazi regime was responsible. So if they admit that it wasn't actually clear, I mean, which means if it was unclear, it means that nobody could show that it was, that no, people didn't even really believe. It really wasn't the National Socialists who cut him off. Something else cut him off. Kind of like if I get cut off for one reason or another, it's not my enemies doing it or something. It is some technical problem. So in April 1933, though, Bonhoeffer raised the first voice for church resistance to Hitler's persecution of Jews. April 1933, he just got in office, and he hadn't done much, but already Bonhoeffer was complaining that he wasn't treating the Jews right, and he declared that the church had to do something about it. And by the way, the Jewish declaration of war on Germany was April 24th, 1933. So in that same month, Bonhoeffer joined with the Jews to attack Adolf Hitler. That just shows, you know, how early he started before even anything, there was anything much to complain about. All right, we're going to the break now, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be listening to the wonderful voice of Dietrich Dieskau.
Länger Strippinos, lass ihre Hunde heulen vor ihres Herren Haus. Die Liebe liebt das Wandern, Gott hat sie so gemacht, von einem zu dem anderen, Gott hat sie so.
Back, and you are back, and it is March 17th, 2014. This is the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and it is St. Patrick's Day today. We're moving right along here. We're in good shape with my preparation for tonight, and I was talking about the Christian pastors who gave such a hard time, gave such opposition to the regime of the National Socialist regime of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. And this Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, is one of the worst ones. By the way, that the singer that you just heard was Dietrich Fischer Dischow. I've forgotten. There's a Dietrich Fischer Dischow. Oh, I think it's the last one. And that was from Schubert's Winterreise. And the song is the actual song is the good night song, where a man is leaving a lover, her home, where he has been staying for some time, but he thinks that their love has grown cold, or she doesn't really care for him that much anymore, and he is voluntarily stealing away in the night and singing about it. It's quite lovely. Too bad we don't know the German, most of us. But all right, so we're back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, so who is considered such a great and sacrificing spirit for freedom and truth, etc., today, and at that time also, at least right after the war, as soon as the war was over and the Allies won. So the point, he had started this, I think Niemöller started the Confessing Church. Actually, Bonhoeffer didn't start it, but he was involved in it. And the Confessing Church was, there was this effort to make a German Christian church, and a lot of German Christians and head church people, were cooperating with it. The Protestants, it didn't include the, Catholic, the Roman Catholic Church, because that's, you know, they're not going to do that, but they thought they could do that with the Protestant Church and create a German church like Britain had, that has the Church of England. So that was underway, but then there were these church people who didn't like that idea at all and who wouldn't go along with it. Bonhoeffer was one of those people. He was a leader amongst those people. He was one of the main people, and they called their church the Confessing Church because that was the true confession, so to speak, the true Lutheran confession. They were Lutheran. That was about all of the Protestants in Germany were the Lutheran Church. And it was not a large church. It didn't have a whole lot of the people. Most of the people, I think, were in the other one. Although I can't say that for sure. It gets very hard to get that clear. I'd have to go back into some other information that I didn't go into for this. But they opposed the Hitler government. That's what they did. They said, we're opposed to this government. And they had this thing called the Barmen Declaration, which was drafted by the liberal theologian Karl Barth, who was very well known and talked and in the 60s, I recall. He was really a big name back then. And it was adopted by their confessing church. And it insisted that Christ, not the Führer, was the head of the church. Well, you see, that's where they're trying to make out that if this national German church went through, that the Führer would be the head of the church, not Christ. And so this was, you know, their argument. So we come along here, in 1933, in the autumn of that year, and Bonhoeffer is, I do it all the time, I'm doing it backwards. It's Bonhoeffer, not Bonhoeffer. He got disheartened because they weren't able to fight the National Socialists and very well. They weren't doing very well. And so he went back to London. He got a 2-year appointment as a pastor of two German speaking churches, Protestant churches in London, the Evangelical Church in Sydenham and the German Reformed Church of St. Paul's at Whitechapel. And he had found little support for his views, even among his friends. So they didn't have a lot of support at that time still. It was 1933. But he wasn't going to give in. So he left and went to London and he spent 2 years there. And while he was there, he kept in contact with Martin Niemöller, who formed this Confessing Church, and he stayed in Germany, and they were in contact with one another. But the thing is, Martin Niemöller had been a pro-National Socialist in the beginning. But I should have this here, so I don't have it right in this spot. But he changed over, when he saw that he didn't think, he just after a while changed his mind. And maybe that's when he formed the Confessing Church. And I don't know, I have the exact date right at the moment when that took place. But Bonhoeffer was rallying people in international gatherings to oppose the German Christian movement. So there again, he was working against Adolf Hitler's desire for Germany in right out there in the open. And he didn't like the idea of amalgamating the Nazi nationalists. They always use the word Nazi, you know, the nationalist idea with the Christian gospel. So there again, you have, he's one of these Christians. And they weren't all that way. A lot of them were saying, okay, we don't mind being German Christians. We love Germany. We're patriotic. We like this new regime. And, you know, we'll work with this. This went on for a few years, this struggle trying to get enough of the Protestants to vote it all in, but there was always a hardcore group that would be able to veto it or something like that. So, okay. So then, while he was in London, Bishop Theodor Heckel, who was the official in charge of the German Evangelical Church. I think that was the German Christian Church, the German Evangelical Church, Foreign Affairs, Protestant bishop. He traveled to London to warn Bonhoeffer to abstain from any ecumenical activity not directly authorized by Berlin. And that is by the Berlin Church, not by Berlin government, they didn't like what he was doing. The official, well, I guess the German Evangelical Church might have been, the regular church that had always been there. They didn't like what he was doing and they told him to stop doing it, but he refused to abstain. He refused to stop. So he was a real rebel. He was stubborn and, he wouldn't obey his own bishop. So I just say that he turned out to be a total traitor to Germany in favor of internationalism. Everything about him was he loved internationalism. He loved the world government kind of thing and the ecumenism. And he always got along with international Jewry. Obviously, he went along with everything they wanted. You have to wonder, I think he just was like that, but he was brought up that way, but he was obviously in contact with all these, with these groups too. So in 1935, he did go back to Germany, and he headed an underground seminary called the Anti-Nazi Confessing Church. So he created his own group there, which was underground. And their purpose was to train confessing church pastors in Finkenwalde, which was a place. And in August 1936, his authorization to teach at the University of Berlin, which I guess he was doing and had been earning a living that way to some degree, was revoked after he was denounced as a pacifist and enemy of the state by this very Theodor Heckel, who was the bishop that went to London to talk to him. He denounced Bonhoeffer. So Bonhoeffer's efforts for the underground seminaries, his work included securing necessary funds, and he found a great benefactor in a woman named Ruth von Kleist-Retzau, and the von Kleist. Von Kleist were also involved in the German resistance. So they were people who were anti-Hitler in general. And they were also Prussians and aristocrats. And it says that in times of trouble, Bonhoeffer's former students and their wives would take refuge in this Ruth von Kleist-Retzau's Pomeranian estate. As we know, Bonhoeffer was, something was in Pomerania, but Pomerania is in, West Prussia, and there's always a lot of Jews in that area because they had been there for a long time, I guess, and, But these were German aristocrats who didn't like the changes because they didn't like the National Socialist philosophy. And so they were helping out with this resistance that was going on underground and quietly for a long time. And so then Bonhoeffer fell in love with Kleist Retzau's granddaughter, Maria von Weidemeyer, and they became engaged 3 months before his arrest. Well, he wasn't arrested yet, but so this took place some time later. But in August 1937, now we're moving up 2 years after he's been spending his time building up, working at this underground seminaries. Heinrich Himmler decreed that this education and examination of the Confessing Church ministry candidates was illegal. This underground seminary was illegal, and in September of 37. The following month, the Gestapo closed the seminary at Finkenwalde. And in November, they arrested 27, or by November, they had arrested 27 pastors and former students, probably sent them, you know, gave them a trial and sent them for a time in a concentration camp or something. It was around this time that Bonhoeffer published his best known book, The Cost of Discipleship, which was a study on the Sermon on the Mount, in which he not only attacked cheap grace as a cover for ethical laxity, but also preached costly grace. That is, he was the cost of discipleship. Is like you're gonna. He was always big on following Jesus and doing, sacrificing yourself and sacrificing a lot of things and taking the hard road and being willing to pay the price, whatever the price might be. So he called it costly grace. Well, he spent the next 2 years secretly traveling from one Eastern German village to another to conduct seminary on the run, supervision of his students. And they were working illegally in small parishes within the old Prussian ecclesiastical province of Pomerania. Again, Pomerania plays a big role in all of this, where they felt they where they kind of headquartered. And so by 1938, the Gestapo banned Bonhoeffer from Berlin. He couldn't go to Berlin anymore. And in the summer of 1939, the seminary moved to another place, and they managed to do that. Another von Kleist family estate somewhere else. And in March 1940, see, he still hadn't been arrested or anything. He was still going around doing what he did. In March 1940, the Gestapo shut down the seminary there. That was after the outbreak of World War II, March 1940 already. So in between this time, World War II broke out. And Bonhoeffer's sister Sabine had a Jewish husband, and they and their two children went to England. But he had another sister named Crystal, who was married to a Hans von Donjanyi, who was of Hungarian ancestry. And Bonhoeffer knew him, of course. And in 1938, he had made his first contact with members of the German resistance through this brother-in-law, Hans von Donjanyi, who was a fairly major figure in the German resistance. And it said that he pronounced, the Hungarian pronunciation of his name is the emphasis on the first syllable, Donjanyi. In Hungarian, Donjanyi. How, of course, I don't know exactly. I'm doing that quite right, but he then changed it. He changed the pronunciation to the accent on the Donjanyi, so it wouldn't sound so Hungarianish. But But I think he was born in Germany, but his parents were from Hungary. So he was, Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, and, he introduced Bonhoeffer to this group seeking Hitler's overthrow at the Abwehr, German's military intelligence unit, and, that is, where he worked. He worked there, and he worked under Wilhelm Canaris. And they were doing a lot of, they were doing the work they should do, plus they were doing secretly a lot of things they shouldn't be doing, they shouldn't have been doing. And in this we find that now Bonhoeffer becomes a full traitor, not just a religious protester. He's not just protesting for God or the church or whatever, but he's now involved with the real bad guys in the German resistance. And he, supposedly he learned from Donjanyi that war was imminent and was particularly troubled by the prospect of being conscripted. And as a committed pacifist, he opposed the Nazi regime. He could never swear an oath to Hitler. He didn't want to be, you know, conscripted because he wouldn't be able to do it. And then he didn't know what they would do to him if he refused it. And he felt also, he was also concerned that if he refused military service, that it could have a bad impact on on the confessing church, because even there, it was a move that would be frowned upon by most Christians and their churches at the time. So even the people in this confessing church believed in the military service. They didn't believe you could refuse it. They believed in the war and supported the war. It was just these leaders, a few people that were fighting against it. But that doesn't mean that all the parishioners were doing so. They weren't. They never were. Which is an interesting thing to keep in mind and to remember. So now this is when, because of this, because of war, people, friends, supposedly encouraged him to leave the country and go to the United States again. In June 1939, he went because the Union Theological Seminary in New York invited him. And so that was all worked out. And, you know, I realized right away that he was running away from what he called costly grace. He had already published his book about it, that you had to pay the price, you had to stand up, and now he was failing to do so. He was going off to safety. So he realized that too. And after he got there, he had inner turmoil and he regretted his decision. And despite strong pressures from his friends to stay there, he decided he needed to go back to Germany. And he wrote to Reinhold Niebuhr, that the famous man at the theological seminary. He wrote this to him, supposedly: Christians in Germany will have to face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying civilization. You see how wrong this clergyman was. You see how he had gotten himself to believe that Christian civilization could only survive by the defeat of the, what he thought of as the Nazis. And I don't know if they thought of them as that then. I don't know when they started calling him that, but with a defeat of Hitler and his government. And that, if Germany won the war, if Germany had a victory, then it would destroy civilization. You see how crazy? But this is the way these people thought at the time, some of them, not many of them, but enough of them, or they talked themselves into it, and this is the way they talk now. And if the German, I don't know who all these, you know, these people like Bonhoeffer might have been in communication with to get these, to build up these ideas. But this is what their idea of Christianity, caused. I just want to emphasize that for them, you know, it was, the world was important and their country, Germany, was not. And they couldn't accept, the nationalism. They couldn't accept the nationalism. So I need to speed up a little bit here. Time's going by fast. So, let's see. A lot of this I just added today. I don't really need to say it all. From this point on, they were restricting him more and more, but they weren't harming him. In 1941, he was forbidden to print or to publish. He was even allowed to join the Abwehr, the German military intelligence, after all that he had done and said, because his brother-in-law, who was not suspected of anything, the Hungarian Donjanyi, who already worked there and had probably a pretty big position, brought him into the organization on the claim that his wide ecumenical contacts would be of use to Germany, thus he protected him from conscription. But this is, Bonhoeffer became a courier for the German resistance movement, but also his, as far as everybody else was concerned, I don't know if he was a courier for the Abwehr, trying to, work out some peace with different groups. He was doing the work that was supposed to be for the Hitler government. But at the same time doing that, they were contacting allies and trying to send messages to allies and so on, trying to get the support of the allies for their resistance movement, and trying to secure peace terms with the allies, which shows how naive they were, you know, and that they believed all this stuff, that they could accomplish things like this. And the British government ignored everything that they sent them, but they still tried to keep going with it. And at the same time they were doing this, they were also secretly helping German Jews escape to Switzerland, through the Abwehr contacts and so on. But on April 5th, 1943, Bonhoeffer was arrested, and he spent a year and a half in Tegel prison because they didn't want to execute him, and they didn't know exactly what he was guilty of, but they knew they didn't want to have him running around anymore. And because he and Donjanyi were both arrested at the same time, because something came out that showed that they were doing these things that I just described. So, and then after the July 20th plot on Hitler's life in 1944, there was the discovery in September, of the secret Abwehr documents relating to the conspiracy. And Bonhoeffer's connection with the conspirators was discovered. And then they sent him to a Gestapo high security prison. And then he was, in February 45, he was moved to Flossenbürg concentration camp. In April 1945, April 4th, think how late that is, the diaries of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris were discovered. And Hitler read them, and he saw that this was a huge, huge net of treason. And he ordered that all the Abwehr conspirators be put to death. And so on April 9th, our friend Pastor Bonhoeffer was hanged with fellow conspirators, Wilhelm Canaris, Hans Oster, who's a terrible guy, Karl Sack, he was a military jurist, General Friedrich von Rabenau, businessman Theodor Strunk, and German resistance fighter Ludwig Gera. And Hans von Donjanyi was executed separately in Sachsenhausen on April 8th or 9th. And I say, I'm glad they got these guys before they could be liberated. Now, Martin Niemöller, I could go through him pretty fast. He was arrested in July 1937. Not until then. But as I say, he started out as like a supporter of Hitler, and slowly we say this here, but he was another Prussian. I mean, not all that Prussian. I'm not sure, but he was born in Lippstadt, which was still considered a Prussian province. And you can look that up, but you know, I'm not going to describe all that. But he was he was one of the founders of the Confessional Church. But when at some point he came to vehemently oppose the Nazis, what they call the Aryan paragraph, why don't I have that here? I don't know. I guess I was going to look at the page. Well, I'm not going to take the time. So he made remarks about Jews that some scholars have called anti-Semitic back early on. But when he started opposing the state control of the churches, and he wrote something. What is this? The Stuttgart Declaration. No, that's later. Okay, well, he started speaking out a lot. He decided that he needed to do that. I think I have that a little further down. And so they arrested him and put him in Sachsenhausen. And he was there, and then later Dachau. But he was there from 1937 to 1945. And, you know, he was treated all right. He then was sent with those high profile prisoners down to Austria right at the end of the war, and then he was liberated and so on, and so he survived everything. He's the one who wrote that famous poem. First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unions, and I did not speak out. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. But he says that he created multiple versions of that. Nobody knows what is the correct versions, because there's been several of them put out. And amongst the things mentioned in these different versions are the communists, the incurable patients, excuse me, the Jews, or Jehovah's Witnesses, and even civilians in countries occupied by Nazi Germany. So, he's got a long thing here he's written, but I'm not going to read it. But the thing about him is that he went from being a conservative and a supporter of National Socialism to being a real liberal. In 1961, he became president of the World Council of Churches, and he earned the Lenin Peace Prize in 1966. He was one of the initiators of the Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt, which said that the Council of the Evangelical Church of Germany, of which he was a part, confessed guilt for its inadequacies in opposition to the Nazis and the Third Reich. So they made it official that they accepted their guilt for not doing enough. I wanted to talk a little bit about the White Rose Society, and how with all these groups and all these people, it is that they put the others first. And the thing we're trying to understand here a thing we're trying to change in white people is to realize that that we have to have this this interest in ourselves. We have to defend ourselves and not be defending non-whites around the world. But that's what these people are all caught up in. And what and the thing that I didn't make a very good job of pointing out is that when it came down to it, they were not too troubled until it came to the Jews. Even Niemöller says that when he was not too, there was not too much of a problem with the, he said they didn't care too much about the, okay, he says, he wrote this, he says, the communists, you know, when they went after the communists, we in the church, or we still let that happen because, we didn't like the communists either. And when they went after the trade unions, well, we let that happen because, we didn't care too much about them. And we even let the social democrats happen when they imprisoned some social democrats. He said, all that was not our affair. The church did not concern itself with politics at all at that time, and it shouldn't have anything to do with them either. We didn't want to represent any political resistance per se in the confessing church, but we wanted to determine for the church that that was not right. They wanted to determine that what was not right, even though they couldn't do anything about it, but they wanted to have the church on record saying, you know, we don't think this is right. We don't go along with this. So they created this Pastors Emergency Federation in 1933 already, and they put as the fourth point in the founding charter this: if an offensive is made against ministers and they are simply ousted as ministers because they are of Jewish lineage, that is, or something like that, then we can only say as a church, no. And that was the fourth point in the obligation. And that was probably the first anti-Semitic pronouncement coming from the Protestant church. So again, like all the rest, they could allow things for other people. They could allow the political things. But when it came to the Jews, they couldn't allow that. And obviously there were ministers in the church who had racially Jewish, who had become Christians. And if the National Socialist regime was going to come and say, no, we can't have any racial Jews in the Christian church, they weren't going to tolerate that. So that's where they were going to say no. It's kind of interesting how it's always about the Jews. So now we're going to turn to Edward Miliband, the Polish Jew pretending to be a British leader, is what I say, because I find it kind of shocking. Now, Edward Miliband was born in University College Hospital in, Camden or somewhere. And his mother's name was Marion Kozak. She was a human rights campaigner and an early CND member, whatever CND is, a Polish Jew. She survived the Holocaust, it says, thanks to being protected by Poles. The Poles protected her, and she survived, she says. And Edward Miliband's father, and he has a brother named David Miliband. His father, Ralph, was a Belgian-born Marxist academic of Polish-Jewish origin who fled with his parents to England during World War II. So he was born in Belgium, and he became a Marxist academic. And he went to England and he fought, got into the military and he fought on the British side. And then, his mother came later to England and they married, and they're both Polish Jewish, Polish Jewish, racially. His father had an academic post at the London School of Economics, and he left it in 1972 to take up a chair at Leeds University as professor of politics. So they were a somewhat you know, they weren't nobodies. They were very integrated into the academic world of Britain. And they moved to Leeds in 1973. And Edward attended school there. And, you know, he says that he was brought up. I'm going to read something by him. Anyway, before I get to that, he spent two spells living in Boston, Massachusetts when he was seven and when he was in junior high school. And this made him very, you know, he's a very regular guy. He says he's never really, he wasn't brought up very Jewish. He's not religious as a Jew, and he just, you know, likes American culture and so on. And just a couple years ago, he married a British woman, not Jewish, named Justine, and they have two sons. So these sons will be half British and half Jewish, half Polish Jewish. And so they may really take the world by storm, but okay, in a magazine, The New Statesman, in May 2012, they had a whole issue entitled who represents the Jews in who speaks for British Jews? Who speaks for the British Jews? And he didn't write that article. He wasn't featured in that article, but they got him to write a column, a guest column. And this magazine, this issue was all about Jews. It has all these other Jews into writing things for it and writing about it in columns by Jews. And the whole thing is about British Jews. And there are British Jews are so in like Flynn, you know what I mean? They're so solid there. But they still like to talk about, oh, how we're just this special group, you know, and we're not the majority or anything, and we don't have real power. We have to get influence when we can. We have to have somebody speak for us, and you know, it's a special kind of, they see themselves as so special. And Ed Miliband wrote something for this magazine because as he's building his political career, he's downplaying his Jewishness all the time. And now the Jews are starting to complain about that. They don't like that, the way that he acts like he's not really a Jew. And so he's trying to figure out where he can position himself in all of this. So he won't turn off the British people by being too Jewish, and he won't turn off the Jewish people by not being Jewish enough. So I think it's good to just read what he says here, because it's so revealing as to how they play this game politically, to pretend like they're, you know, that they're not serving Jewish interests at all, when you know they must be. So he says the first Jewish leader. This is a quote. The first Jewish leader of the Labor Party. That's what he's been called. He says, it says something about me and about Britain that I am rarely described as such. He's rarely described as the first Jewish leader of the Labor Party, which he thinks that says something good about Britain, because they don't think of him as Jewish. He says, I'm not religious, but I am Jewish. My relationship with my Jewishness is complex, but whose isn't? My family history often feels distant and far away, yet the pain of this history is such that I feel a duty to remember, understand, and discuss it, a duty that grows rather than diminishes over time. As children, we were only dimly aware of it, but we caught glimpses. That is, you know, he's saying his parents didn't even bring him up very Jewish. I mean, they just didn't pay attention to it. They were very English. When I was seven, my family went to visit my grandmother in Tel Aviv. Pointing at a black and white photograph, I demanded to know who was that man in the picture. I remember being taken swiftly out of the room and then being told quietly that he was my grandfather, David, who had died in Poland long before I was born. It was only some years later that I realized my mom's father had died in a concentration camp, murdered by the Nazis for being Jewish. You see how he adds that? He didn't know anything about it, but later on, well, it didn't make any impression when he was young, and he says nobody bothered him about it. But later on, he's realized that his mom, he calls his mother his mum, just like all the English. My mom's father died murdered by the Nazis for being Jewish. That's what he believes. Now, if that's what he believes, well, you know, that's not good for, in my estimation. He then says, before she arrived in Britain in 1947, my mother had spent the war under an assumed name, being sheltered by heroic people who took her in. My dad came here in 1940. He would happily talk about his time in the Royal Navy during the war, but for a man who could discuss almost anything, he generally steered clear of the events that brought him here. Oh, chilling music playing. Oh, the events that he had to face before he left and got shelter in wonderful Britain. As a 16-year-old, he caught one of the last boats from Ostend to Britain. Ostend is a place there in Poland or on the Baltic Sea. The family had decided, with German soldiers closing in, that Jewish men were most at risk, so his mother and sister were left behind. He did not see either of them again. Now, this didn't sound like him writing this, but that's what's in there. He's writing about his father. That's right. The family had decided that his father, who was 16 at the time, should be sent away while the mother and sister were left behind. He did not see either of them again until after the war was over. Mm-hmm. Like many of others from Holocaust families, he's calling himself now a Holocaust family, I have a paradoxical relationship with this history. On one level, I feel intimately connected with it. This happened to my parents and grandparents. On another, it feels like a totally different world. When I was in my late 20s, I went back to Poland with my mother to visit the town of Częstochowa, where she had spent so much of her childhood. As we left a house in which she once sheltered, you know, putting it that way, a house in which she once sheltered, a man pointed at us, shouting, "The Jews are coming to take back their property." That was another glimpse of the world she had come from and an echo of the ancient hatreds that propelled my family to Britain 70 years ago. Now he's playing on the British people. You know that, oh, you know, you are such wonderful people and you represent freedom for all us refugees and persecuted people. And, you know, you sheltered us and we're able to leave all that ugliness behind and come here, you know, and, you know, this idea, he could have made this story up totally. Because they're always saying that whenever these people go back, all these Jews are always saying that, coming up with these stories that, well, I went back to my hometown and looked for the house I grew up in. I just wanted to see it, you know. And then all these Polish people started yelling at me, "What do you want here? Go away," because they were afraid I was coming to get our house back again. They're always saying that. I don't know if it's true or not. See, I mean, you can't. It's just a story he's telling. And we know how the Jews tell stories. So I don't put a lot of credence in it. So he continues, "So how can my Jewishness not be part of me?" There it is. "It defines how my family was treated. It explains why we came to Britain. I would not be leader of the Labor Party without the trauma of my family history." Meaning they would never have come to Britain without all that. And that's what drove them to Britain. And that's what allows him to now be leader of the Labor Party. "For me, my Jewishness and my Britishness are intertwined. My parents defined themselves not by their Jewishness, but by their politics. They assimilated into British life outside the Jewish community. There was no bar mitzvah, no Jewish youth group. Sometimes I feel I missed out. And yet, I did not miss out on many other aspects of Jewishness. My mom got me into Woody Allen. My dad taught me Yiddish phrases. There's no better language for idiomatic expressions, some of them unrepeatable. And my grandmother cooked me chicken soup and matzo balls. Although, he's trying to point out that he is Jewish, even if he's not very Jewish. You know, his upbringing had enough Jewishness in it, even though he really didn't partake of a Jewish upbringing. So then he goes to his wife. Although my wife, Justine, is not Jewish, my Jewishness is part of me. So when we got married last year, we broke a glass at our wedding, an old Jewish ritual. I will explain, they got married last year. That would be in 2011. So he very carefully married a non-Jewish British woman for the ambitions of this family become important political agents in Britain. That's the way I see it. And she went like, you know, always find somebody to go along with it. He says, I will explain our heritage and the connection to my boys. Or he'll explain to his boys his Jewish heritage and their connection to it. And I will encourage them to identify with it. There he is, going to bring them up identifying as Jewish. And when they have got past CBeebies, whatever that is, some teenage thing, I will sit down and watch Woody Allen with them. So for him, Woody Allen personifies Jewishness that he likes and thinks is acceptable, I guess, to everybody else who doesn't like Woody Allen. But what about being leader of the Labor Party at an event organized recently by the Jewish charity Norwood? A member asked me whether being Jewish complicated my approach to Israel or the Middle East. Well, of course it does, you know. And he's going to Jewish charity events, and there's only about 500 Jewish charities there, and they're all doing things just for Jews and for Israel. But anyway, he says, he answers this question with an emphatic no. I support a two-state solution because I long for the peace that both Palestinians and Israelis need so badly. And if that says something about me, it also says a lot about Britain, that I know I will be judged not for my background, but for what I believe. Again, he's telling the British people how wonderful they are and that they're not prejudiced and that they will not judge him on his race or any of that, but only for what he stands for. He says, I also get to do things as leader of the Labor Party, which I might not have had the chance to do before. Listen to this. One night, I went to a dinner with Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Britain, where we sang a traditional prayer. I remember thinking my grandparents, their grandparents too, would have said the same words. So, you know, he's just starting to really get in touch with his Jewishness. It's so wonderful. And then he says, I have seen the huge contribution the Jewish community makes to our national life, in business, in charities, in arts, in culture. It is a strong and confident community, proud of its Jewishness and proud, too, of Britain. In a way that I would never have realized when I was growing up, the patriotism of the Jewish community. The patriotism of the refugee is something I now see existed in my dad, even though he might have denied it. All right, he talks a little bit about his dad here. And then he says, I was not indoctrinated with Marxism. Whereas his father is an old Marxist. His father was taught that in some university or school, taught Marxism. But he's trying to tell us that his father did not indoctrinate him in that, nor was I brought up with religion. So he don't worry about him being a religious Jew. But I was given a sense that the world could be a better, fairer, and different place. And we all have a duty in our own way, in our own time, to seek to make it so. That's how he ends. And now, isn't that something? You just see what he says. The world, his whole philosophy, his religion, his everything is that the world can be a better, fairer, and different place. You see, he wants to change the world to make it better because it's not good enough. See, this is it. You see, what the British have done in the world of the British is not good enough. It's not fair. And it needs to be changed. It needs to be made better. It needs to be different. For what? For the minorities, of which the Jews are one. And they stand up for all the minorities because they know they will benefit from that. So that's how he goes about it. And I wonder how many people would even give a thought if they would read this. Of course, probably mostly just Jews reading that magazine. But, you know, if he's talking like this in general, people just pass over all this stuff and just think, well, he sounds all right. You know, he sounds pretty good. So I don't have much but a couple minutes here, but I've got a few other notes here about the EU. You know, the EU membership is a big issue right now, and Ed Miliband has said that he has promised the voters that I will give us an in-out referendum. He will allow them to vote on an in the EU or out of the EU, he says. But then he adds, but only if there is another treaty requiring a further substantial surrender of national powers to Brussels. Now, and somebody's writing about this and says the cunning of this is that by making our continued membership of the EU conditional on our accepting such a treaty, he has put both the other major parties firmly on the spot, and says that Cameron's Conservatives and Clegg's Lib Dems are just as firmly committed to remaining in the EU as Mr. Miliband, and that they are committed to remaining in the EU, but pretending like they're open to leaving it. And by tying the two issues together, he's making it impossible for all three parties to do anything but to campaign for a yes vote, because here's what he's saying. If the EU votes on another treaty requiring more surrender of our national powers to Brussels, after that new treaty is voted in, then I will give us a vote on the in-out referendum. So it's a real tricky thing here that's been brought up, and I don't have time to say any more about it. I have to thank you for listening tonight, and tell you that this being Monday, be sure to listen tomorrow night to Tan Stoffel's Age of Treason program, and on Thursday we'll be doing the Hitler's Table Talk again. Thanks for listening, and good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.